Tonight on Standing Room Only, Trumpism before Trump, Rust Belt populism during the 2008 and 2012 elections.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
From May 31st to June 3rd, the Working Class Studies Association held their annual conference at Indiana University. Each day, there were several rounds of panels and speakers. On June 1st, opening plenary speaker Josh Bacevich placed the American populist moment in a historical and social context. We begin with an introduction from Working Class Studies Association President Michelle Fazio.
I want to begin by telling a story, because I kind of stalked him, but vis-a-vis Colby King. So Colby emailed me and said, "Hey, Michelle, you might want to check this person out and see if he could just learn more about the association." So I believe I gave you a phone call and you weren't answering your phone. It was like winter break. So I emailed him and it was kind of an awkward exchange to say, "Hey, would you like to become our plenary speaker?" So I want to thank Colby, because Colby's been helping me co-manage the website. But Colby's also been very active in connecting the dots. And of course, as a fellow sociologist, he connected this and brought Josh here. So we're really thankful for that. And happy that you responded so graciously to the invitation. I'd like to introduce Josh Bacevich. He earned his PhD in sociology from the University of Chicago and spent 2 years at Stanford University as an ASA-NSF fellow on the current economic crisis before joining the faculty at Brown. His first book, which is available, Partisans and Partners, The Politics of the Post-Keynesian Society, examines municipal and partisan politics in two Rust Belt cities to arrive at a radically new account of the sound and fury within contemporary American politics. The book shows how changes in American federalism, especially the corporate merger waves that followed 1970s era financial deregulation and changes in the prevailing logics of intergovernmental finance, reshuffled each city's leadership class, creating opportunities for the emergence of coalitions predicated on the avoidance of divisive issues in favor of broad-based partnerships. His work, he's going to talk mainly about this, but his work has also appeared in the American Journal of Sociology, Social Problems, Socioeconomic Review, and City and Community, and won multiple awards, including the ASA's Jane Addams and Charles Tilly Awards. Josh has also written about municipal finance, the Obama campaign, Rust Belt politics, and Donald Trump for popular outlets like the Washington Post and Salon.com, and some of those essays are what really Colby had seen and recommended. So currently you're working on two projects, and I think you're going to talk a little bit about those today. So we're really happy to have you here. So please join me in welcoming Josh Bacevich.
Thanks, you guys, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's always downhill after the introduction, right? But thank you for that generous introduction. And I'm actually going to talk mostly about the old research. That is the book. So I probably don't need to do a lot of work to convince you that our politics has gone off the rails. And as the title of the keynote suggests, I want to talk about Donald Trump and his connection to the so-called white working class. So where we're going to be going today is to Iowa, and I should say again that most of what I'm talking about is based on my recent book, which focuses on community level and party politics in two Rust Belt cities in Iowa. So as you may or may not know, Iowa is a traditionally Democratic state. It's about 90% white, overwhelmingly blue collar. Historically, the eastern portion of the state has been industrial or post-industrial and lean Democratic. The western portion of the state has been more agricultural and Republican. But if you look at the map in 2016, the news is really not good, right? So in 2008, Obama wins 55 out of 99 Iowa counties. And Hillary Clinton manages to carry just 6, barely. And these are the counties where Iowa's largest cities and college towns are located. And that, of course, is a pattern repeated across the entire industrial Midwest and it's what gets Donald Trump into the White House, right? So the 2016 ballot is over here. So what are we to make of this? I hope I'm not alone when I say that analysis of the 2016 election, for me anyway, has at times been sort of frustratingly devoid of historical context, right? So the way it often works is someone goes out, they find someone who looks to them like the white working class, they interview them and they come back and they say, well, you know, it turns out people are really angry. Maybe they're racist, they're angry about immigrants, they're angry about urban elites, what have you. All of which might be perfectly true, but there's often not very much historical context, right? So it's that kind of historical context that I want to try to provide in today's talks, at least in the kind of cities that I examined, specifically by, so I should say that I will talk at the end for maybe 5-10 minutes about what it is that Iowans on the ground thought in 2008 and 2012, but I want to spend most of the time talking about political and economic changes in these cities that I studied and how they changed people's political intuitions and expectations in ways that ultimately make something like the wave of Rust Belt populism that we saw in 2016 possible. So if we're going to do a historical take on Donald Trump, I think we first have to think about long-term historical trends in American politics. I would argue that the most important one of these is something that sometimes gets called partisan polarization, although I think a more apt characterization is the sort of parting of company between American politicians on the one hand and voters on the other, right? So when I talk about a parting of company between politicians and voters, I'm really talking about two trends. The first one is that politicians are more divided by party than ever, which is to say that their party affiliation is a stronger predictor of the policy positions that they advocate. So if you map congressional votes, for instance, as these social network analysts have done, what you see in the 50s, 60s, and 70s is a purple clump, which suggests that some Democrats are consistently voting to the right of Republicans and vice versa. By contrast, starting in the 90s or 2000s, you start to get these two discrete clusters, which suggests that essentially all politicians within the same party, whether self-avowed moderates like Hillary Clinton or radicals like Bernie Sanders, or some people might say, right, are essentially voting the same in virtually all cases. And this polarization by party in Congress and elsewhere contributes to bickering in Congress, the common correct impression that our parties are more divided than ever. And it's against this hyper-partisan backdrop, I would argue, that something like Donald Trump starts to look possible or even maybe normal, right? And actually, this first trend is fairly surprising given trend number two, which is that contrary to popular wisdom, Americans' affiliations with the two parties have actually loosened over the same period. So I should say that partisan sorting in the electorate has actually increased, which is to say that if you hold consistently conservative views, or consistently Democratic views for that matter, let's say you hold consistently conservative views, you're much more likely to identify strongly as a Republican today and to see the other party as a threat to the nation's well-being and what have you. But the key point is that voters of that sort are still in the overwhelming minority, and a number of analyses, for example by Baldessari and Gilman, suggest that they're more responding to the polarization of political elites than vice versa, right? Conversely, partisan polarization in the electorate has not really increased, or by some measures, increased only slightly and recently, which is to say that if you pick an American at random, they're still overwhelmingly likely to hold a mixture of ambivalent liberal and conservative views, and that really hasn't changed much over the years. What has changed is that American is much less likely to identify unambiguously with one of the two political parties. So the Pew Research Center tells us that rates of independent identification are at a 75-year high, and there's a strong intergenerational component here, wherein generally speaking, each generation identifies as independents at higher rates than the one that came before upon attaining the age of political maturity. We saw a little bit of this in 2016 when surprisingly 15% of white millennials voted third party. And it's also reflected in qualitative studies. For instance, if anybody has ever read Avoiding Politics by Nina Eliasoff, or you probably see it among college students too, where a lot of young people express these views that politics is somehow inherently off-putting and incomprehensible, and in some ways incompatible with how it is that we should go about solving our local problems. Politics is something to avoid, right? So how is it that both of these trends can be going on? So what I do in the book is I draw upon a branch of political science that makes the following argument. You know, if politicians are not being responsive to voters, then they must be being responsive to something else, namely local party leaders and activists, those who play a central role in partisan efforts and party electoral efforts at the grassroots. And this argument actually kind of makes sense if you think about it, because these local party activists and workers are the people that politicians get disproportionate face time with when they're out on the campaign trail, and they're the people whose support they need to win primaries, which we all know in a lot of districts virtually guarantees you a general election win, right? Moreover, it is the case that grassroots party workers have changed fairly radically over recent decades. So here I'm drawing upon a foundational work on this topic by John Aldrich, who's a political scientist, and he makes the following argument about grassroots parties. So traditionally in the United States, say in the 1960s and 70s, grassroots parties were dominated by activists and leaders that he characterizes as materially motivated activists. So these were basically local elites and notables who maybe cared about one or two political issues, but really looked to politics primarily as a way of enriching themselves and cementing their local status. But crucially, the composition of those local elites changed from place to place. And that in turn gave politicians an incentive to engage in a strategy of conflict displacement. So imagine, for instance, that you're a Democratic politician and you're trying to tie together this geographic coalition that consists of, you know, a blue-collar political machine in one city, a progressive coalition of white and blacks in another city, something else in a third city. The way that you're going to do that is you're going to do it by taking a hard stance on one issue that can rally that base, maybe like the New Deal or the Great Society or the Civil Rights Bill or something like that, but ambiguous positions on the full range of other political issues, immigration, guns, and so on, so as not to upset anybody within that coalition. Then in the 70s and 80s, grassroots parties get taken over by so-called ideologically motivated activists. These are basically weekend activists who play no particular role in community governance and are really coming to politics just because they care deeply about the issues, and crucially, all the issues. So now politicians have an incentive to engage in the strategy of conflict extension, to take a hard stance on the full range of partisan views as a way to kind of mobilize their base. So there's a number of things in this account that we could certainly quibble with. For instance, I would quibble with the sort of weirdly abstract kind of rational choice-y language he uses to talk about party leaders at the grassroots. But nevertheless, I think he's got his finger on something important. And indeed, since publication of the book in 1995, a number of empirical studies have shown that essentially the story checks out, that it's really grassroots party workers, not so much regular voters, who have changed radically in recent decades, becoming much more extreme and consistently partisan in their views vis-a-vis the general population. So what I do in the book is in some ways take this larger question of, you know, how did our politics get so crazy, and address it by thinking about this more circumscribed question: why is it that community leaders withdrew from party politics and activists took over in the first place? I should say that there's two existing accounts that I want to touch on just briefly. The first one comes from political science and focuses on party nominating procedures. So the argument here is that traditionally the way that we've picked candidates, particularly presidential candidates, is in conventions and these sort of smoky backroom situations. Now, of course, we do it mostly through caucuses and primaries. And the argument is that because community leaders can't dominate caucuses and primaries, they lose interest in politics outside of their borders and turn inward for self-enrichment. The second account comes more from sociology, especially Theda Scotchpole and Doug McAdam, focusing on changes in the field of policy advocacy in the United States. So traditionally in the United States, policy advocacy was carried out by so-called federated associations. These are organizations with well-organized local chapters, regional coordinating bodies, and national mouthpiece organizations. Think about something like the labor union or the NAACP that maintains local chapters. And the key point is that in that system, national elites are financially dependent on local chapters for dues, and because of that, they make a lot of efforts to educate people at the local level via lecture circuits, newsletters, and just a general kind of educational campaign, right? Then what happens in the United States in The 1970s and 80s is the field of policy advocacy changes. We get new kinds of civic associations like that Scotchpole describes as bodiless heads. Think about Sierra Club or something like that, various right-wing groups that don't have local chapters and really just raise money by making targeted appeals to niche demographics. So these organizations no longer have a need for local chapters and they break ties. And in Scotchpole's words, because local leaders lose their connection to the national polity, they become parochial in outlook and focus not in my backyard protest. So obviously these two accounts are really interesting and I draw on them in various ways and they're all getting at something. But what I want to, and I can talk more about them, but what I really want to point out is that they make a similar kind of assumption about the political outlook of local community leaders, namely that before the 1980s, community leaders were intensely interested in politics outside of their borders. After the 1980s, they've become inward-looking and kind of parochial in outlook. And crucially, that can't be right because it runs contrary to most of urban political history and sociology, which tends to characterize urban elites in the opposite fashion. Before the 1980s, they're typically described as more managerial and inward-looking. After the 1980s, they're almost universally described as entrepreneurial, trying to cobble together outside resources to make their plans happen. So in some ways, the puzzle here is, as community elites are becoming more entrepreneurial and outward-focused in general, why are they losing interest in partisan politics in particular? So to foreshadow, the answer is going to be something like, it's not so much that activists come in from outside and take over grassroots parties from community leaders, but rather community leaders voluntarily withdraw. And that has to do with shifts in American federalism that really transform the nature of community governance. So it's a local transformation story. And in particular, these federal policies both alter the profile of local leaders and change the kind of coalitions that they put together in order to solve their local problems in ways that ultimately make them politics averse. So that's where we're going. And as I indicated at the beginning, we'll get there via this comparative study of two Rust Belt cities in Iowa. These are cities of roughly 100,000 people. I have anonymized them, River City and Prairieville. So the pictures you see here, not actually the cities I studied, rather cities that look a lot like them, just to give you the idea. You could kind of think of them as like Bloomington minus the university, I guess you could say. So the book is really revolves around analyses of this case, these cases, and obviously also triangulating that with literature on what happened in other cities. And concretely, the study consisted of three parts. I spent a lot of time interviewing local leaders and observing community affairs. I did various kinds of archival analyses, focusing especially on the relationship between community governance and the two parties. And I interviewed a panel of roughly 100 people across both cities at several strategic points during the 2008-12 election cycle. So in the book, I focus kind of equally on these three parts. I spend a third of the time answering this question, well, why did community leaders pull out of politics? A third of the time trying to figure out what the consequences are for grassroots parties and the bigger political system. And a third of the time focusing on what is it that regular people think and how has that changed? Because I do want to provide the political economic background, I'm going to focus mostly on the first question in the talk. But I'll spend maybe 5 to 10 minutes talking about consequences for grassroots parties and what regular people think, ultimately coming back to this question of the white working class at the very end, right? Maybe just the working class in general. So what did I find? So the first big surprise of the research was I kind of expected to just come out and do a study where I interviewed people about politics. I started interviewing local elites just to get the lay of the land and kind of figure out what these places were more like. And they immediately started spontaneously talking to me about a transformation of public life that they claimed happened in the 1980s and resulted in a new style of public engagement, which they termed partnership. And they would talk about this transformation using a number of metaphors. So for example, little kid versus adult metaphors were quite common among leaders, right? So before the 1980s, it was like community leaders were like children. They were petulant, they were fighting all the time. You know, now we've grown up. We figured out how to identify the divisive issues and set those aside and really just focus on the points of consensus. Probably the most common metaphors were table metaphors. Before the 1980s, it was like community leaders sat across from the table from one another, pounded on the table and fought. You know, now what we do is we sit around the big round table, we figure out what the lightning rod issues are, we take those off the table and really just focus on these provisional points of consensus, right? So these kinds of analogies are suggesting that something fundamental about community governance has changed. It used to be about these sorts of warring factions that fought over resources, and I should say that people identified those factions especially with, on the one hand, labor union leaders who were centrally involved in democratic politics, and on the other hand with local business owners who were pretty involved in the Republican Party. And then sometimes in the 1980s, it comes to be about setting aside divisive issues and focusing on these provisional points of consensus, i.e. partnership, which community leaders insisted was somehow incompatible with divisive identities and specifically engagement in the two political parties. And I'll show you in a second that this transition actually did happen using various kinds of archival records. So I obviously spent a lot of time thinking about why is it that community governance changed in this way, right? And eventually I started thinking about federal policies. So the story here is going to be something like community leaders are always relatively focused on their immediate goals, the pecking orders they have with one another, and so on. But those local activities unroll within an envelope of federal policies that structure that interaction, both by determining who it is that has the resources and time to be a community leader in the first place, and in the kinds of coalitions that they form to get their problems done. And specifically, I came to focus on two kinds of policies, financial and business regulations, and systems of intergovernmental finance, especially social service and urban funding. So the story is that both of these things changed in the 1970s. Before the 1970s and 80s, they're pushing community leaders to form these sorts of oppositional and politically inflected factions. After the 1980s, they start pushing them to form these broad-based partnership coalitions that are incompatible with politics in some sense. So the easiest way to show you that is to just go through it historically and think about the pre-1980s period first, and we can think about financial regulation and business regulation. So we know that the New Deal era financial system was highly regulated vis-a-vis today, right? So via mechanisms like subdivisions between different kinds of financial institutions, restrictions on interstate banking, created a financial system that sociologist Gerald Davis tells us was credit scarce from the point of view of America's largest corporations. So America's largest corporations had a lot of trouble getting credit. They took their capital and they held on to it as the sort of internal financing, which crucially meant that they acquired other firms really only to balance their internal cash flows, not as they would start to do in the 80s in order to eliminate their competition or in order to achieve vertical and horizontal integration. And from the point of view of my cities, that was important because it sheltered a local urban economy that consisted mostly of locally owned firms, right? So what you see here is the 15 largest private sector employers in my cities are mostly locally owned, i.e. by people who actually live in the community, right? And that's important, that those economic institutions were important because they empowered two categories of traditional leaders in the city. So we can take an example, the River City Packing House, affectionately known as the Pack. It's a big meat packing operation, hired 3,500 people at its peak. And at the one hand, was empowering the sort of local business class. So you had the owner of the Pack, Romberg Sr. He was a big wheel at the Chamber of Commerce, centrally involved in the Republican Party, also a member of various kinds of civic clubs and charities that catered to upper class tastes, things like the City Symphony Board, for instance. Then you also had the children of the owner of the Pack and senior managers who were similarly engaged in civic life, in business groups like the Chamber, the Republican Party, elite clubs and charities, and also in local politics. So actually one senior manager from the Pack was elected to city council in the 1970s. On the other hand, the Pack was also unionized and paid high wages, particularly for the 60s and 70s, which also endowed the Meatpackers Union with a lot of institutional capacity, right? So the Meatpackers could afford to maintain a full-time building, staffed by a full-time secretarial staff, and pay six full-time organizers who were not on the shop floor, but rather representatives, I should say, but rather out in the community, organizing unions, centrally involved in democratic politics, various kinds of clubs, charities, philanthropies that focused more on working class needs People still refer to these sometimes as blue-collar charities, although there's really not a lot of them left in the cities that I examined, and also involved in local politics. So, in fact, two meatpackers were also elected to city council during the 1970s, right? So in some ways, these economic institutions are enabling these two categories of leaders that are out in the community fighting one another. And the fact that they're fighting makes sense if you think about the broader system of finance, of intergovernmental finance in which they're operating. So here I'm talking about both social service and urban funding. In some ways, it's easier to see it with the urban funding, so I will just kind of focus on that as an analogy for both. So a quick primer on New Deal era urban policy. During the Great Depression, a number of American cities go bankrupt or come very close to it. Afterwards, there's a bipartisan consensus that fiscally healthy cities should be a federal responsibility. And in addition, unlike today, both political parties are competing very hard for the urban vote, which results in a series of ever more generous sort of urban bills, right? So you get urban renewal is a bipartisan initiative. You have model cities and various kinds of great society programs. Surprisingly, the most generous urban bill of all on a dollar-for-dollar basis was Nixon's revenue sharing. And via these mechanisms, federal transfers come to constitute 20% of municipal budgets by the end of the 1970s. And crucially, the political compromise that gets made during this period is that it's okay to expand the scope of federal involvement in cities so long as you don't grow the federal bureaucracy. That was something that the Republican Party was trying to put a check on. And that in turn created a system that historian John Mollenkopf characterizes as a banker government. So essentially, the federal government lacked the capacity to administer all of these urban programs that they were creating, and instead sent over large discretionary transfers to local bodies and commissions, and essentially allowed people on the ground to implement these programs as they saw fit. And the key point is that that created a local world that was highly tolerant of conflict, and in some ways even encouraged it. So here we are in the downtown district of one of the cities that I studied. It's the 1960s. There's a bunch of old buildings here that are a fire hazard and so on. And a bunch of chamber-backed candidates on city council decide that they want to use urban renewal to redevelop that downtown district. But of course, they're going to do it in a way that's consistent with their symbolic and material interests in the city. So what happens is labor union leaders get wind of this. They decide that they actually want to spend the money differently. And because of that, the conflict over the urban renewal actually coincides with election of the city's first union-backed mayor, who gets into power along with two other labor-backed candidates, appoints a different urban renewal commission, and restructures the development of the city more or less with a stroke of a pen, right? So I think the take-home point here is that in some ways the mayor's apparent political autonomy is politically constructed or enabled by these generous Keynesian-era federal transfers that are really left up to local discretion. In the book, I show how New Deal-era urban policy mostly had this feature of transfer discretionary grants to local bodies, which in some ways gave locals an incentive to form these oppositional factions, because if they could dominate these local coalitions, even with majority control, they could then exercise unilateral control over both local and federal monies. And if you look at the city more systematically, warring factions is what you see. So this is just one of my cities, but the other one looks similar. This is a social network analysis. Sociologists and related disciplines use this to map the organizational structure of a field, right? So the nodes here are organizations, the ties are overlapping membership on the board of multiple organizations during a period of time. And I've color-coded it just so we can see what's happening. And what's happening essentially is you've got two pretty discrete clusters of organizations. So on the one hand, you've got business groups like the Chamber and Industrial Development Council. They're very tightly integrated with local branches of the Republican Party, and also various kinds of elite civic clubs, things like the Symphony Board. On the other hand, you've got labor union coordinating bodies like the Labor Council. They're quite tightly integrated with local branches of the Democratic Party. And interestingly, among the only organizations that really broker between these two factions are your democratically elected and appointed groups in yellow. These are like city council or the Citizens Advisory Commission. which it won't surprise you to hear, were sites of endemic labor-business conflict during this period, right? So stepping back, what we have, to borrow a term from the book, is partisan politics embedded in community governance, right? So community governance is characterized by this two-sided overlap between sort of between economic institutions, business versus labor. Those overlap with a set of exclusive social and civic clubs, and respectively branches of the Republican Democratic Party, right? So remember that embedding or overlap, because it's going to become important when I start to talk about what regular people think, particularly people who came of age during this period, right?
You have been listening to Trumpism Before Trump, Rust Belt Populism During the 2008 and 2012 Elections, on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Josh Pasevich place the American populist moment in a historical and social context. He was the opening plenary speaker for the Working Class Studies Association Conference, which took place in early June at Indiana University. We now return to the show, with Josh Pasevich and the rest of his presentation on Rust Belt populism during the 2008 and 2012 elections.
So stepping back, what we have, to borrow a term from the book, is partisan politics embedded in community governance, right? So community governance is characterized by this two-sided overlap between sort of between economic institutions, business versus labor. Those overlap with a set of exclusive social and civic clubs, and respectively branches of the Republican Democratic Party, right? So remember that embedding or overlap, because it's going to become important when I start to talk about what regular people think, particularly people who came of age during this period, right? But before we get there, we have to talk about the change. So here we are in the 80s, and the first thing that really hits these cities hard in the 1980s are the consequences of financial deregulation, right? So we know that there's a bipartisan push to financial deregulation in the 1970s. This causes an economy that's suddenly very credit rich and also causes interest rates to move about wildly. That's a particular problem for manufacturers like the ones that are anchoring the economy of my cities, because they're trying to buy inputs on credit, and in a regime of high and volatile interest rates, they can't make a profit. So essentially their cash on hand is low, but the value of their assets is high. And under these circumstances, you have the emergence of a new kind of actor on Wall Street, your takeover specialist, which specializes in essentially buying up, chopping up, and reselling industries like those that are anchoring the economy of the cities I studied. Other corporations get into the game too, because we're now in a regime of very lax regulatory enforcement, and that precipitates what economic historians agree is the largest merger movement of the 20th century, the largest corporate merger movement. So essentially, locally owned industries in my city are being bought up during this period. It's also not a good time for labor, and this period of corporate consolidation is also a problem, because in a lot of cases these industries are being liquidated or shut down. So what you see is that in one of my cities, the number of full-time representatives goes from 140 in the 1970s to just under 60 about 10 years later. So, and then by the time you get to the 2000s, you see that most of the companies in the city are no longer locally owned, right? They're owned by corporations headquartered elsewhere. So essentially what's happening is, during this process, you're losing those traditional leaders, both business and labor leaders, that were most invested in the conflicts of the past. And it's also the case that the environment in which they're operating is radically changing. And here again, we can see this really clearly by looking at urban policy, right? So it's actually Carter who first starts making rumblings about fundamentally altering American urban policy, but for various reasons, he never gets to it. So it falls to Reagan, who comes into office and announces that he wants to end the fiscal relationship between cities and the federal government outright. which he actually very nearly does. So early on in the administration, there's bills that phase out revenue sharing, various Great Society programs, community development block grants are slashed in real dollar terms. Over the course of the decade, the Department of Housing and Urban Development goes from 11% of the federal budget to 2%, and federal transfers go from almost 20% to 3% of municipal expenditures. So there's a lot of public sector rollback, but in fact, it's not just rollback, because as subsequent administrations step back from the extremism of the Reagan years, they never return to these discretionary Keynesian grants of the New Deal era. Instead, they start to apportion funding to states and also middlemen nonprofits, and to dole it out in the form of competitive grants rather than discretionary transfers. So in some sense, community leaders are still questing after the same federal dollars as before, but now these federal dollars are confronting them not as discretionary funds embedded in local commissions, but rather as this dizzying array of grants that they have to cobble together to get anything to happen. So what's the consequence for how they solve their local problems? So here we are back in the downtown of the same city we were looking at earlier, a little bit closer to the harbor. The manufacturing crisis has just happened. We're in the 80s, right? And so there's a bunch of abandoned factories and stuff. And community leaders really want to do something about these abandoned factories, but of course they can't use urban renewal or other programs like that because they no longer exist. So they think about what to do, think about what to do, think about what to do. And finally they say, aha, we're going to build a historical museum. Because the historical museum is going to both replace some of these abandoned factories and hopefully revitalize development in the harbor. This is a very common strategy, right? You see it all over the Rust Belt. But the key thing is that in order to achieve that historical museum, they have to market the plan to a lot of outside agencies and foundations, right? So of the museum's eventual $200 million price tag, only about 8% comes from a federal appropriation. They get another $40 million from a competitive state grant, and they cobble together the rest of the money from a dizzying array of organizations, everything from the Carsigi Foundation to the National Endowment for the Humanities to the Iowa Department of Economic Development to NASA. They actually get a NASA grant to build the historical museum, right? So what you see the speaker saying here is that this effort to market the city took this new mode of engagement partnership. And actually, that's not a surprise, because if you're going to market this thing successfully, you have to present it as lots of different things to lots of different people, right? So to one set of funders, it's something that's going to create local jobs. To another set of funders, it's an educational institution. To a third set of funders, it's an architectural marvel. And the most effective way to do that place marketing strategy is to put together coalitions of people that agree to work together and represent that thing to that outside set of funders. So if it's going to be something that's going to create local jobs, you've got to have labor and business together at the table saying, you know, we need this thing. If it's going to be an educational institution, you have to get the teachers union together with the head of local colleges saying, let's get together and build this, we need it. So the key point is that as long as everyone is willing to avoid points of division and just engage strategically in these place marketing coalitions, then you can get the money flowing again by sort of getting the outside money that you need. So what happens in the cities that I studied and a lot of other ones is that this new ideology of partnership becomes really firmly ingrained as the official ideology of the city, if you will. This is in part through the founding of new kinds of organizations, your so-called economic development organizations. So here's somebody who started one of these organizations talking about it. And he essentially says, you know, historically there was a chamber in the city, but like that's not what we're about, because the chamber was just an old boys club and it's just a business thing. What we are is a big tent, right? So we bring in everybody, we figure out the points of division, the lightning rod issues, we set those aside, and we really just focus everyone's attention on the issues where we can work together and get immediate results. So this is actually where like the big round table in the city is constructed in practice, if you will. And if you look at things more systematically, the big round table is kind of what you see. So the organizations in brown are your economic development organizations. They've become quite central to the organization, along with things like the River Museum that include a lot of community leaders who identify as partners. And as these organizations have become more central, other kinds of organizations have become more peripheral. Particularly,
democratically elected organizations and branches of the two political parties, right? So you see the Democratic Party kind of starting to move out towards the edge, and then local branches of the Republican Party are really on their own, almost disconnected from community governance entirely. So what you have essentially is party politics disembedded from community governance, right? Community governance really revolves around these partnership coalitions that try to market the city, and party politics is separate from that, and in some ways even opposed to it, right? So that is the end of part one. And the answer here is that indeed it is the case that community leaders have pulled out of grassroots parties, as other studies have found. But it's not, as some people have argued, because community leaders have become more parochial in outlook. In fact, just the opposite. It's rather that federal policies have restructured urban governance in ways that makes local problem solving paradoxically incompatible with the kind of presentation of self that you have to affect is incompatible with participation in party politics. So now I just want to touch on two quick consequences, the first one for grassroots parties. So essentially what's happened in this process is we've gone between two different types of grassroots party organization. Before the 1970s or 80s, we had what we could term community leadership parties, in the sense that those who were central to urban governance, either as business or labor leaders, were simultaneously central to the Republican and Democratic Party, right? And it won't surprise you here that under that scenario, community leaders spent a lot of time disciplining incoming activists and really focusing their attention on the kind of issues that concern them in community life, mostly business versus labor distributional struggles, away from the kind of hot button issues that get a lot of airtime in contemporary politics, right? Immigration, abortion, guns, and things of that sort. Now what we have is more of what you could characterize as an activist party, wherein those who are central to partisan organization at the grassroots play no role in community governance. They come in just because they care deeply about the issues. I should say that in both cities I studied, Democratic parties were somewhat less activist than the GOP parties, but nevertheless, I think the shift was pretty pervasive among both, so there's definitely a trend. And that's important essentially for two reasons. First, because activists care deeply about the full profile of partisan issues. And second of all, I found that there were these interesting intra-party processes among activists who, unlike community leaders, are characterized by a flat status hierarchy. They're this community of equals, right? Which in some ways sets off processes that polarize the party and make it appear more partisan than the sum of its parts. Some of these are pretty straightforward. So activists in the activist party are exposed to one another's point of view, and they index solidarity one another by tolerating one another's extreme viewpoints, right? So think about it, you're a Republican, right? You come to a local branch of the GOP because, not people I interviewed, by the way. So you're a Republican, you come to the GOP because you care deeply about reducing the role of government. But unlike before, there's no bigwig from the Chamber of Commerce running the whole thing. It's just a bunch of activists walking around trying to proselytize one another. So you're going to encounter a lot of people who care about abortion, say, and depending on how you feel about that, you might feel like you need to soften your opposition to their views or even adopt their views in order to create this collective solidarity, right? Activists can't police use of the party label, but tend to circle the wagon in the face of community ridicule. This one, I think, is really important. So again, within some of the Republican parties that I observed, there would always be this circumstance wherein there was a splinter group of Republicans who was doing something that other Republicans also thought was kind of out there or crazy, right? So there'd be like people consistently picketing the Planned Parenthood clinic, or there was a guy who ran for county auditor on the platform of abolishing all property taxes. Initially, other Republicans were like, I don't know about, not go there. But then when these people started to encounter ridicule from community leaders and local media and so on, then they would circle the wagon and say like, well, at least like our people are trying to have a serious conversation about taxes. I don't know what you guys over there are doing. So this is just a mechanism that sort of makes the party more cohesive than the sum of its parts in some ways. There's also these dynamics of intra-party polarization. It happened especially around conflicts about who it is that should have positions of symbolic leadership within the party. So for example, within the Democratic Party, some activists would try to make the argument, and the argument's always revolved around political purity, if you will, right? It's those who are most fully committed to the full range of issues are the ones who should lead us, is the essence of the argument, right? So Democratic Party, some activists would make the argument that union leaders shouldn't take positions of leadership because they care narrowly about the economic issues and not the social issues, which actually wasn't even fully true, but nevertheless, activists made that argument sometimes successfully, right? So these are all dynamics that further polarize the party and distance it from the kind of things that are getting airtime in community affairs, which is of course consequential given the outsized role that grassroots parties have in both acquainting politicians with local needs and in determining who makes it through primaries, which determines who it is that represents us at the state and federal level. And finally, we can come back to what it is that regular people think, angling back to this issue of the white working class. In the book, I do this again by talking about ideal types of voters, both those that attained the age of political maturity before the 1980s and see that old community organization as a model for what politics should look like, those versus those who are younger and attained the age of political maturity after the 1980s. Obviously, I can only kind of give you a taste of that argument, but I think it should start to make sense. First, let's talk about these traditional voters. So these were people who came of age before the 1980s. And in some ways, the really interesting thing about the American electorate in the late 20th century was the existence of these voters who had relatively ambivalent views about most political issues, but were highly, highly, highly committed to one of the two political parties, almost like instinctively, right? I should say, by the time I did field work in the 2000s, people of this generation were already getting on in years, but nevertheless, there were a lot around, and I talked to them. And so you say to yourself, how is it that somebody can not care about the political issues, but be highly committed to one of the two political parties? And I think the answer is that is the sort of embedding of party politics and community governance that I talked about earlier. Because essentially the fact that economic cleavages, social cleavages, and political cleavages in the city were one and the same meant that people could use various aspects of daily life as a heuristic or guide for making sense of politics, if you will. So one thing that came out a lot in these interviews with traditional voters is that people would use a lot of non-political distinctions to make political claims, right? So they would say, for example, you know, the job I work or the neighborhood that I live in or the way that I spend my leisure time even is more inherently Democratic or Republican, right? And that's essentially what these two informants are doing. And I should say that of the 100 or so people I spoke with, Patricia and John were by far the most politically uninformed. So neither one of them could recall who the major party nominees were in 2000 and 2004, even though I interviewed them in 2007. Political scientists usually say, well, if you don't know anything about politics, you can't form a political opinion. But actually, these people do so pretty easily just by using various aspects of local daily life as a guide, right? So Patricia's like, well, you know, I subscribe more to the business mindset, so that makes me more of a Republican. John is like, well, I don't really pay a lot of attention to politics, but maybe it's like with the union, you vote for your guy, otherwise you don't get what you want, and I'm more of a union person, and therefore I'm more of a Democrat, right? By contrast, these sorts of straightforward political identifications were something that I found that younger people especially had a lot of trouble doing. Instead, they tended to perceive a natural tension between, on the one hand, party politics, and on the other hand, community governance, or maybe even just sort of common sense notions of how it is that we go about solving our public problems. But interestingly, they responded to that tension in two very different ways, either as partners who sided with community over politics, or as partisan populists who were very angry about how things were going into their community and were looking to politics as a sort of panacea or cure-all. So that's where we're gonna start moving towards Donald Trump. But first, let's think about these partners. So here's Will, a young professional in his 20s. he may as well be somebody taken from one of these qualitative studies of what it is that young people think about politics, in the sense that he sees politics as inherently off-putting and contrary to the way that everyday problems get solved, right? I'm sure that other people have heard opinions like this expressed in their classes, where he's like, well, I try to vote because I know I should, but on the other hand, it looks like politics is just a cynical conflict between two sides, and it's pretty clear that we'll never get anything done unless we can come together and set our divisive issues aside. So, like, I vote, but my response is really repudiation of politics. Like, I don't really understand it or like it, right? And then by contrast, we have these angry populist voters who we've all heard so much about in 2016, right? So here's one example. Essentially, he's saying, you know, I feel like local government, local leadership, everything around me in my communities is corrupt and part of this weird hired class, right? People around here don't really represent me. There's this pervasive experience of downward mobility. But it seems like local leaders are always out there bragging about the recent thing. They're really out of touch, right? And that's why I support like a Christian conservative Republican who's going to tear the system down so we can build it back up, right? And the interesting thing about these partisan populist voters was that there was almost no correlation between the kind of critique they would make of community life and the sort of political project they later espoused. So here's an example of somebody who makes almost verbatim the exact same critique of what's going on in the community, right? He's like, leaders really don't care about the average person anymore. They're just out there kind of marketing the city, but I don't see why, because they're just getting Walmart in here. You know, they don't care about the average Joe and so on. And that's why I support like a radical democratic candidate who's really gonna tear down the system so we can build it back up, right? So in some ways, I think that the distinctive characteristic of these populist voters is not so much that they're angry, because in a lot of cases, traditional voters would be angry too, right? They'd be angry about something that the local business community was doing or the chamber was doing. But the key point is that they were embedded in a social system, or at least remembered being embedded in the social system, that translated those daily, everyday frustration into identification with local unions and, to an extent, populist politicians and city council, and by extension, the Democratic Party, right? By contrast, these partisan populist voters are not united by any sense of positive identification, except for with this vague sense that what we need to do is drive the car off the cliff just to see what'll happen, A, and B, so that we can tear the system down and build it up from top to bottom and bottom to top, right? Cue Donald Trump. So I don't want to belabor the conclusion, because I want to do questions and talk and stuff, but I think that there's two take-home points that are pretty important. So the first is simply, in 2016, we saw a lot of this change in politics as between populist insurgents on the one hand, and on the other hand, your sort of partnery cosmopolitan technocrats on the other, right? This is a framing that certainly, in some ways, was deployed during the primaries, and then certainly during the general election, successfully by Donald Trump. And because this came about so saliently and recently, it's natural to attribute it to, I think, a more recent kind of event, right? So we've heard it attributed to Donald Trump, or maybe even some kind of delayed reaction to the financial crisis, or pent-up animus against Obama. All of those things could be true in part, but I think what this research shows is that Rust Belt populism is part of a much longer political trajectory, because think about it, I was doing this research in the 2000s before the 2008 election. So clearly, this populist undercurrent is something that precedes Trump, precedes Obama, and even precedes things like the financial crisis, right? And the second thing to say, I think, is that this populist undercurrent is part of a real thing, in the sense that the reason why it resonates is it corresponds to a fundamental reorganization of party politics and community governance that was precipitated by changes in federal policy and really resulted in this disembedding of party politics from community institutions that I talked about. So in some sense, there's no model for meaningful public conflict at the local level. What you have instead is the sort of very insider elite politics on the one hand, and on the other, these insurgent groups that are not really, don't have a seat at the table, if you will, right? And for that reason, I think, because it's in some sense fundamental to political and community structures, this populist moment that we're experiencing will probably continue and is not uniquely tied to Donald Trump. Thank you.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were looking at the white working class. I'm curious if these cities were pretty racially and ethnically homogenous back in the 50s, and have they changed much kind of community organization, community governance structures have changed as well?
They have, and that creates some really interesting politics. So especially one of the cities that I examined is has a lot of meatpacking, traditionally still does, so there's a lot of people migrating from Mexico and Central America to work in those plants, right? So that's created some very interesting politics, right? Because in some ways, and I realize I didn't get into it in the talk so much, but in some ways this partnership coalition is very focused on presentation, right? So it's like we have to present ourselves as not only sort of like a business-friendly city, but also a diverse city, right? We've got to get some amenities in here because that's what corporations want, right? So there's a real effort by local leaders in both of these cities, I would say, to at least present front as more diverse, right? So it's like we need to get some of these Hispanic leaders on the Economic Development Corporation so that when CEOs come to town, we can say, look how we're developing our kind of stuff, right? As you can imagine, that creates some interesting politics in the sense of like, well, what's the give and take, right? What are the benefits of doing that? You know, if recent immigrants are not organized, how do you pick somebody, right? Stuff like that. So.
You have been listening to Josh Pasevich place the American populist moment in a historical and social context. He was the opening plenary speaker for the Working Class Studies Association conference, which took place in early June at Indiana University.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio WFHB.